Let's go. My country, tis of thee, land of the free, but not without me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Untangled Resolution's very special presentation of The Problem is the Answer. I'm your host, Batavi Levantombini, and I'm coming to you live from Harlem, USA. Tomorrow is Independence Day in the United States, so it is especially fitting that my guest today is Gary Chartier, author of The Conscience of an Anarchist, Why It Is Time to Say Goodbye to the State and Build a Free Society. On this day, before the day we celebrate the founding of the United States of America, let us ask the question, can you really imagine there's no country? You are listening to the Mighty Third Rail, a mightily talented New York City-based trio. The piece you are listening to is called The New America, from their first album called Classic. I'll tell you more about them later in the show. So sit back, listen, and enjoy. I'll be back with you in just a moment. Our confidence in the promise of something better has ever been brighter. Our potential, glaring and blaring, stirring in our souls, the light ricocheting from one person to the next. This is what a movement looks like when it actually moves. You can blame it on the new America, the new millennium of reconstruction. It is a new age of a new way of thinking. The era of intelligence where we kill fools using logic and idiot carcass, phoenix rising, conjured by consciousness. The resurrection begins. Reborn stands the intellectual. Yo, where you been? Ignorance kept you in past tense. Now rethink your pretense and pretend you're living in the future. Cause that's the only way visions are manifested. So we invested our imagination in the greater nation. And now the task is left to my generation to rebuild this fallen nation, crumbled by corruption. So in the new America we trust, that belief will provide relief to grief. And our heads ain't hanging down cause hope tells us that destiny is willing to turn things around. So our backs are arched erect like the Statue of Liberty. We still clench our fists for the sitting resistance while simultaneously extending our hands, palms open to the sky, marching the progressives. We are citizens feeding for freedom, hungry for some humanity. There is no room for complacency, only engagement and involvement, discourse and dialogue. The core of democracy lungs inside our lungs. We live fully and completely, our hearts beating a little harder, our minds open a little wider. We make no apologies for who we be. Our philosophy, our ideology is simple. We pledge allegiance to truth and equality. Our declaration is independent of stagnance. Our constitution is a union of hearts and minds. We now beat back the Star Spangled Banner and honor the principles of the forefathers. Finally put to practice and cheerily mourn the legacy of the slain freedom fighters. Serve as a reminder of a bit of history. So we say amen to amend the wounds of the past. Correcting our wrongs, we build our rights to karma and pray for a tip on how to lift the fallacies of extreme capitalist mentality to redeem our spirits. This is the moment when a culture's consumption shifts to moderation and attempts to break the present state of hysteria in an old America in order to lay claim to proclaim sanity in a new America. Here is where a self-professed revolutionary finally, proudly, wholeheartedly embraces the radical spirit of Patrick Henry to become a hyphenated American revolutionary, ready and steady to usher in a new and improved red, white, and blue America. My country, 'tis of thee, land of the free, but not without me. My country, 'tis of thee, land of the free, but not without me, but not without me. Hey, but not without me, oh, but not without me. Yeah, but not without me, oh, but not without me, but not without me, but not without me, but not without we, 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 but not without we. Welcome to the show, everyone. If you are just tuning in, this is Untangled Resolution's presentation of The Problem is the Answer, and I am your host, Batavi Levantombini. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in couples and divorce mediation. If ending a relationship is your healthiest choice, I can guide you through the process so that you don't lose your shirt or your mind. Before we start, if you are listening to the live broadcast, you can participate in the show. The chat room is open. If you're listening online, please feel free to join in. You can ask questions there, and I'll be checking in from time to time. You can also call in to listen, ask questions, or make comments. The number to call is 818 532-9789. Press the number 1 if you wish to participate on the air. Please do not press number 1 if you don't want to participate, because I won't know that you don't want to be on the radio and I will come to you. So again, press number 1 if you want to be heard on the air. If you don't want to be heard on the air, just call 818-532-9789 and you can listen in on your hands-free device. I've been anticipating this show for months, and I'd like to take a moment to thank my friend Chris Reeves, who first put me in touch with today's guest. Gary Chartier is a legal scholar and author of a new book called The Conscience of an Anarchist: Why It Is Time to Say Goodbye to the State and Build a Free Society. We are celebrating the founding of the United States of America tomorrow, a society built on the principles of freedom. But not everyone agrees that we are actually free. Gary Chartier is an anarchist who argues that our current system of government is not only broken, it is actually dangerous. Now, I'm happy to welcome Gary to the show. We're going to discuss this very provocative point of view. Gary, your mic is on. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. I'm so glad that you're here, and I've enjoyed the chance to read your book and to delve a bit into the ideas that you bring forth in the book, and I'm happy to share them with my audience. You know, tomorrow is the 4th of July. It's Independence Day. What goes through your mind on the 4th of July?
Well, like everybody, I enjoy holidays. But beyond that, I guess, in connection with this book, I think of this. The Declaration of Independence makes the claim that just governments derive their powers from the consent of the governed. And as I look at this government, but also any other government I can think of, it's pretty hard to see much evidence that most of the governed have consented. That's probably what I'm reminded of each year here, that it feels like there's a bit of a fiction underlying the authority of states that claim that they rest on the consent of the governed.
Well, and this is something that you've been thinking about for a while, I'm sure. So why don't we do this first? Let's introduce you to the audience. Let's hear a little bit more about your background and how you have come to write this book.
Sure. My background, I guess, I'm a native Californian. I'm still in California. I'm the associate dean of the business school at La Sierra University in Riverside, California. I did an undergrad degree in history and political science. I did a PhD in theology with a dissertation about the idea of friendship, in which I spent a fair amount of time thinking about political issues. And then I went to law school at UCLA some years after that. I certainly had been reflecting on issues of political authority and freedom in the state for a long time. And indeed, probably in early adolescence, might have started along a path that really would have led me much earlier to calling myself an anarchist. But I took some interesting detours after that. What really, I think, led to the production of this book was the radicalization I experienced during the last decade as I watched the U.S. government go crazy in a variety of ways. War, torture, surveillance, massive bailouts to favored corporations. These things deeply troubled me, and it became increasingly apparent to me that despite the rhetoric, people in both of the U.S. The government's major political parties were very much on board. And this definitely propelled me toward a position which I was just increasingly suspicious of the claims that politicians made, increasingly open to looking to alternatives.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned radicalization, and it does seem to be a rather radical direction to go into, especially considering the mainstream in the United States and just how deeply entrenched that mainstream is. And also when you speak of radicalization and you talk about calling yourself an anarchist, I mean, that seems to be a pretty revolutionary thing to do, especially considering that the common idea, I suppose, that people have of anarchists, who anarchists are and what they stand for, is probably shaped by images that they have of, you know, young people violently protesting or rampaging even through various cities where there are G8 summits. That seems to be the main exposure that most people have to anarchists. Tell me a little bit about anarchism and whether those images at all relate to what you're talking about.
Well, Absolutely. I mean, I think the those images are very powerful in people's minds, just like a few generations ago the image would have been, as J.R.R. Tolkien said in calling himself an anarchist, images of you know, men with funny hats throwing bombs. It's easy to be dismissive of anarchists, and it's been quite common to be. But look, the word anarchy just means fundamentally the absence of rulers. And that's really the position that I want to defend. Now, there are some people who think that the best way to get to a society without rulers is to engage in chaotic violence. To my mind, that's to do more of the same. That's exactly what's wrong with rulers. They engage in aggressive violence. That's what makes them problematic. And so I don't want to see rulers opposed using the same techniques and the same strategies that they employ. If we look back, you know, the history of anarchism is long and complicated, and obviously we don't have time to go into all the details here. We might go as far back, for instance, in Western history to Étienne de la Boétie, the friend of the famous French essayist Michel de Montaigne. Boétie, in an essay that is commonly called in English The Discourse of Voluntary Servitude or The Politics of Obedience, points out that state authorities maintain their power precisely because people continue to go along with them. And the implication, I think, is clear that you might be able simply to withdraw your consent and in so doing really lead to a change. You know, if we move forward, the famous 18th century English political thinker and friend of the American Revolution, Edmund Burke, wrote an early essay in which he quite clearly defended anarchist ideas. Later in his career, he insisted that he was really just joking, and it was just a kind of exercise in irony, and historians continue to debate whether he was serious or not, but in any case, he firmly expressed those ideas. You know, in the early 19th century, we've got William Godwin, who was the husband of Mary Wollstonecraft, and therefore the father of Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein, who clearly defended anarchist ideas as well. But it's clearly not until later in the 19th century that anarchism really takes off. In European anarchism, the famous names, the names that continue to resonate with contemporary anarchists, are probably, you know, primarily Pierre Proudhon in France, who was probably the first person to actually use the word anarchist of himself, and Bakunin in Russia and Kropotkin in Russia, who all laid the foundation for pretty radical critiques of what was obviously a very oppressive system in Russia at their time. In the United States, the people who've probably been the most influential, and probably the name most people would be aware of in the United States as regards the history of anarchism, is probably Emma Goldman, who was of course an emigre from you know, from Eastern Europe, but who spent much of her life in the United States. The people I've drawn on are probably even more obscure often than Emma Goldman. The two kind of 19th century figures who've been probably most influential on me are Lysander Spooner and Benjamin Tucker. Lysander Spooner, especially well known as a constitutional lawyer who opposed slavery, but also as somebody who went into business competing with the U.S. Post Office and was actually shut down by Act of Congress, and who was certainly increasingly radicalized by events immediately before and then during and after the Civil War. And by that time, Spooner had decided that there was just no evidence that the U.S. government enjoyed the consent of the governed that it claimed, and he wrote some just devastating critiques under the general heading, The Constitution of No Authority. Tucker, who was a generation younger than Spooner, very much influenced by Proudhon, and somebody who argued in a very comprehensive way for an attractive picture of anarchy that involved really eliminating state-secured privilege across a whole range of fronts. So, you know, we get into the 20th century, and there are all sorts of people we could name. Probably the most famous anarchist working today in English is Noam Chomsky, but there are all kinds of other people who are anarchists for whom there's a great deal to be learned. And we can certainly talk more about that.
Sure. Well, I mean, it sounds like a pretty significant and impressive critical mass of people to join, and you have joined in. You've written this book. Tell me a bit more about what inspired you to write the book.
Well, there are lots of ways in which people approach critiquing state power. And I tried to think about what considerations would be most telling to people who thought about the world the way I did. I was somebody who came back to a kind of anarchist position after a long stay in other sort of districts of American political life, and I was somebody who, you know, really, you know, was radicalized in a variety of ways during the 90s, but who in a lot of ways was a pretty conventional, you know, probably kind of mainstream, you know, modern liberal / social democrat. And as I found myself moving to an anarchist position, I asked, well, what are the factors that would really be most telling if somebody like me were the audience? And I decided that while it certainly mattered to note, for instance, that arguments for consent didn't seem very persuasive, while it certainly mattered to note that there had been a variety of social experiments in the past that had demonstrated, I think, the capacity of people to organize themselves without the state, what really mattered to me was just how risky and dangerous state power seems to be. And so the three central chapters of the book were ones in which I tried to make that case, focusing respectively on the way the state parcels out privilege in the economic realm to the wealthy and well-connected, ways in which the state makes war and causes tremendous suffering and destruction because of war and the associated national security state, and finally the way in which the state constantly infringes on personal freedom and personal privacy. And those kinds of dangers posed by the state really seemed to me to be the most important things to highlight, and I felt like a small, punchy book that focused on them really could help to open some people's eyes.
Well, and you know, you're right. The book is quite focused and straightforward. That's one of the things I appreciated about it, is that it very clearly and succinctly outlines your arguments for anarchy and your arguments as to why the state is actually dangerous. And that is the thing that really caught my attention, of course, is the idea of the state being dangerous. Of course, people think of the state as being there to protect them, and that, you know, they consent to the power of the state in order to enjoy those protections. But you're saying something quite different. Of course, one question that comes to my mind is, well, don't individuals do those things anyway? You know, the things that you're saying
individuals...
the state. Pardon?
Don't individuals do the things that the state does that make the state dangerous?
Absolutely.
Well, so ultimately, obviously, the state itself doesn't do anything at all, right? The state is people, just like Soylent Green. And ultimately, people do what people do. But there's a kind of ideology that provides legitimation for what people do. And it enables people, I think, to get away with things. So if we think about the ways in which favored corporations receive privileges from the state, absent the legitimating ideology that support for the state provides, those folks would have to go to their neighbors and convince their neighbors to fork over subsidies to them. I think that would be, let's say, a good deal more challenging.
Sure.
And so, you know, so people, yes, people can do bad and silly and stupid things, but I think unless they're convinced that somehow they have to do those things, or that it's right to do those things, or that it's acceptable to do those things because they're operating, you know, under color of law, those bad things are often more difficult to do. So it's not that you can ever get rid of bad stuff, but I think you can reduce some risks.
You know, I'm curious about examples of societies that would perhaps approximate what you're talking about, or organizations that might approximate what you're talking about. Might there be some examples that you could refer us to?
Sure. So I try to do this in very, very rapid form in the book, and I provide some references for people who want to track down further information. And so let me just move really quickly through these. One really obvious example that we don't think about very much of people interacting in an environment in which there's just not the kind of overarching authority that everybody acknowledges, would be people interacting across national borders. And there, this happens in two contexts. So there are people acting in their official capacity. So states interact with each other, and of course, there's no super state providing a set of rules that they all have to follow. Rather, the rules and the practices and patterns and so forth are negotiated out over time and develop often as matters of custom or convention or treaty among particular states. Also, of course, just individuals engaging in commercial transactions or other kinds of interactions across state borders, again, don't have a sort of overarching uniform legal framework within which to work, and yet they manage nonetheless to achieve orderly solutions to their problems. But if we go back and, you know, a few hundred years, we find similar kinds of things happening. So in medieval Europe, famously, for instance, merchants moving across borders very often resolve disputes at merchant fairs in their own court systems that were not state court systems, but were just maintained by the various merchant groups themselves. We can find within particular industries things like this happening. So there's been, for instance, quite fascinating work done on 17th century diamond merchants in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. the way in which they were able to do this. Pirates is a wonderful example is provided by Peter Leeson's book, The Invisible Hook, which looks at the way in which pirates, obviously not operating under the umbrella of the state, managed nonetheless in the so-called golden age of piracy in the 18th century to achieve really quite orderly legal arrangements within their own communities. So, you know, there are other examples. The so-called Wild West of the 19th century, where the presence of federal and state governments was really quite limited, nonetheless featured a great deal of kind of bottom-up order that people managed to maintain on their own. So, I think there are some interesting examples. Yeah.
Sure. Then yes, just then to sort of push on the examples you mentioned, pirates, which of course is really interesting. Then I wonder, would this framework apply to the mob?
So I don't see much evidence that, in fact, mob families have functioned in the same way the pirates did, and we can talk about why that might be. I mean, I haven't actually thought much about that. It seems to me, in principle, it's possible to imagine not just on the sea but on the land an organized crime family functioning with an orderly internal legal structure. And you know, does that with regard to the pirates or with regard to the mob? Does that make the predation of these groups and others okay? Of course not. I think the example here is only designed to show that even when there's not a kind of orderly external legal framework that, you know, people nonetheless find it possible to reach agreements that enable them to kind of interact stably with each other and to make decisions about the allocation of resources and so forth. So certainly this kind of thing has been discussed with respect to groups other than pirates. There's a dissertation that was just recently completed about the way in which people in a South American prison maintained order on their own, quite apart from what the guards and the warden were doing. You know, so could somebody do a similar study of what happened inside an organized crime family? No doubt. I haven't seen that work.
Right. And you mentioned prison, and I know from some of my own work with prisons that that is something that does happen in prisons. You often will find that an internal structure for organizing and dealing with infractions and creating a scheme by which you understand what infractions are and what kind of behaviors are expected, that you'll often find that coming through from people who are in prison on their own, sort of, that these norms get to develop over time. Gary, this is a perfect point, actually, for us to take a break. Believe it or not, we're already at that point of taking a break. So we're going to take a quick break and then come back and delve a little bit more specifically into a couple of things that you mentioned in the book that I've found to be really interesting, and I think that the audience will be interested to hear your viewpoints on those. In the meanwhile, I am delighted to introduce you to a smokingly talented duo, or trio, actually, Darian Duchan, the poet, Ian Baguette on upright bass and Curtis Stewart on violin. This is the Mighty Third Rail. Now, I don't know the rest of the group that well, but I got to know Ian a bit last February when my mom and I got to hear him play in an impromptu performance at a friend's house. Ian is the truest cool cat I know, and he certainly made an impression on my mom. She and my dad visited me here in New York last week, and every time we went to hear live music, if there was an upright bass in the room, she'd ask, "Hey, do you think that's Ian's bass?" Well, I'm happy to announce that the Mighty Third Rail's work is available on iTunes, so get to clicking. The album is called Classic, and the piece I'm going to play for you is called Definition Resistance. Stick around, I'll be back with you right after this.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, yes, 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 have a seat, have a seat, have a seat.
Come on.
Yes. Take out your notebooks. Today's lesson is it's very simple, very easy to understand. No, please, please, no spitballs. Now, as I was saying before, today's lesson is very simple. As you can see, it's on the chalkboard. It's a little something called definition resistance.
Resistance is more than what meets the eye, hiding behind what you recognize, more than a tagline on a political t-shirt, more than that, romanticized, glamorized dream of citizens hitting the streets, gun raised, ready to blaze, marching towards the White House gate, singing, "We shall overthrow." No, resistance is more like that. Sweet sound of nails on a chalkboard. That snowflake that refuses to melt. That stubborn kid that doesn't believe in Santa Claus. That mustard stain on your Oxford shirt that will never go away. That ketchup that hesitates to come out of its bottle. That pesky plastic cover on a brand new CD that you eventually open with your house key. That family of quarters slipping out of your pocket. High road to freedom. That joke that turns earnest before the punchline. That rock out of the bike when you order it to sit. That beast of a brick shattering the window pane. That dance on an armored tank that granite rock made. That part that rumbles and grumbles as it muffles and muzzles the scene. That drum stick that pops flip stops on all the offbeats. That smell of death in a perfume shop. That cockroach that's immune to gray. Hey, that one eye shaving swimming upstream. That rule that spins the mud lab. That curious cat feline strolling towards ground zero. Resistance? It's the story of the three little pigs on a bridge and not by the hair of my chinny chin chin of the protest champ. Resistance is my resurrected athlete's foot. Oops. That's right, I said it. Resistance is a daily operation living among us with a message that it is, has, and always will be. Part of history. Tattooing your signature on Mother Nature's hips. Placing pieces of a puzzle in our path to assemble. Waiting in the deep end. Sitting in the corner of a crowded tango club. Waiting for you to ask it to dance. Yeah, definition resistance. Definition, definition, definition resistance. Definition resistance. A definition, definition.
All right, everyone, we're back on the show, and welcome if you're just joining in. You're listening to Untangled Resolution's presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a show about the personal, social, and financial issues that concern you most. I'm your host, Batabile Mtombeni, relationship coach and divorce mediator, and I'm broadcasting live from Harlem, USA. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in relationship negotiation and divorce mediation. If ending a relationship is your healthiest choice, I will guide the process so that you don't lose your shirt or your mind. Work out your child support and parenting issues without spending years in court. For more information, visit my website, www.123untangled.com. And that's untangled with a D, www.123untangled.com. The piece you've just heard is called Definition Resistance by a band called The Mighty Third Rail. Their album is called Classic, and it is available on iTunes. I'm happy to announce that the Mighty Third Rail have just released a brand new album called Death Boogie, also available on iTunes, and I invite you to check that out too. I'd also like you to check out the blog that is a companion to this show. You can find it at www.untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. I know that's a lot of dots, and in fact, I've been told that I don't have to say www anymore. So those of us who tend to be a little bit behind the curve regarding technology, there you've heard it. You don't have to do www anymore. You can actually just put in untangledresolutions, that's all one word, .blogspot.com. And that is where you can find links to the resources mentioned on the show today, like Gary's book, and more about the music and the musicians I feature as well. And I have a very special commitment to featuring independent artists here on this show. It is also your opportunity to continue the conversation that started here on the show. So please jump right in and let your voice be heard. UntangledResolutions.blogspot.com. Next week, we are talking about community activism. So we're going to continue in the vein of thinking about who we are as citizens and as members of a community. With so many people unhappy about what is happening in government, what is an ordinary person to do? Gary is proposing one approach, and we're going to continue to talk about that. Next week, we consider another approach. My guest is Kathy Marino-Thomas, the Communications Director and President of the Board of Directors of Marriage Equality New York, a political action committee that led the grassroots effort to make marriage equality the law in the state of New York. I will talk with her about how ordinary citizens can make their voices heard, and not only heard, but become the law of the land. That's what's coming up next week. I have been talking with Gary Chartier, author of The Conscience of an Anarchist, Why It Is Time to Say Goodbye to the State and Build a Free Society. Gary, welcome back to the show.
Right here.
Awesome. There we go. We were talking before we went to break about some of the examples, perhaps, of societies or organizations that manage to create internal forms of organization, rules, and so forth without an overarching state presence. But I think we've been a little bit remiss. I should have asked at the outset, perhaps, what is the state?
Well, so the standard definition of the state is one that we get probably as much as anything from the 19th century German sociologist Max Weber. Weber probably best known for his discussion of the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. And Weber gives us a definition of the state as an entity that exercises a monopoly over the use of force in a particular geographic territory. And we can tweak that a little bit. One of my friends prefers to say that what the state really claims to do is exercise a monopoly over the termination and enforcement of legal rights. But in any event, the idea is that the state is a territorial monopolist. So that's probably at least a useful working definition.
Okay, so a monopoly on the use of force, or a monopoly on certain kinds of power.
Yeah.
Right. And then there is this idea that we have all consented, or there's at least in the Declaration of, in the Constitution, the preamble to the Constitution, they talk about consent of the government, of the governed, not the government, the governed, right?
Well, so in the Declaration, we have the language about the consent of the governed, and then in the preamble to the Constitution, the kind of implicit reference to that with the idea that the quote, people of the United States are involved in establishing and ordaining the Constitution.
Right, and you talked a bit about folks who were speaking about anarchy, I guess, more openly at that time. You mentioned, was it Edmund Burke?
Right. Edmund Burke, probably his stuff about anarchy predates the American Revolution. I think by the time the Revolution happened, he was a more established figure in England. He was still a fan of the American colonists, though not of the French Revolution, but he wasn't talking in anarchist terms by then.
Right. Well, you know, I popped over into the chat room during the break, and one of my listeners, Bill Murray, noted something. He says the American experiment, begun some 230 years ago, was launched by anarchists, and who found a need to establish a set of rules and regulations, meaning the Constitution. And that is something that's interesting to me as well. We understand that the people who founded the United States were, of course, seen as, revolutionaries, and they were about, declaring independence from England and about consent of the governed and all that sort of thing. So I'm wondering, to what extent would they have been influenced by anarchist ideals?
Well, I don't think that anarchist ideas, in the way in which we really might, understand them being kicked off in a big way in the 19th century, were really very much, at least obviously, au courant at the time the revolution took place. I would say, on the one hand, certainly that there are kind of anarchist themes here, right? I mean, it's the case that colonists who revolted were unequivocally denying that there was anything like the divine right of kings. They were denying that, just as a practical matter, it was always necessary to support whoever was in power, because otherwise everything would go to hell. That's a sort of Thomas Hobbes argument. Hobbes's argument for the authority of the state and Leviathan certainly would have been current then. So they were rejecting those kinds of views. They were very fond of John Locke's view that the state had its origin in a social contract. Locke, of course, had written in part to justify some instances of revolt in England, and they kind of took his position and ran with it and said, well, we certainly are free to withdraw our consent from the British crown and set up something new. So there certainly was a vigorous anti-authoritarianism in what a lot of them said. On the other hand, if you read a great new book, I don't know if you're familiar with it, Thaddeus Russell's A Renegade History of the United States. Russell talks about the way in which the, quote, founding fathers, and he instances John Adams in particular, were really people who were unhappy with the degree to which social order of the conservative variety they favored seemed to be dissipating in the pre-revolutionary period, and in some sense wanted to get everyone involved in politics as a way of reestablishing social order and getting people to be more serious and to spend less time partying and playing around and so forth. So I think there's really a social conservatism that's there in the minds of a number of the American founders who would have been certainly open to the idea that people could replace what they thought were bad governments. But I think a lot of them would have been quite uncomfortable with the idea that bottom-up social organization could replace the top-down organization of the state entirely. I mean, I suppose the closest you might find would have been Jefferson's claim that the a revolution every 20 years was probably a good thing. On the other hand, it's not as if he found himself leading such a revolution, and of course, as we know, his practice was not as consistent as his ideology in any case. So, I mean, it seems to me that none of the American founders would have said that I'm aware of would have said I'm an anarchist. Probably the closest, not so well known as Adams and Jefferson, might have been Thomas Paine. Who said things that came very close to being anarchist. Paine, I think, believed in what we might call an ultra-minimal state, and certainly talk in terms that a lot of anarchists have found sympathetic. But so I certainly recognize real resonances between later anarchist writings and things some of the founders said, but I wouldn't want unfairly to claim the founders as anarchists.
Okay. So definitely then, while they held to a lot of what were then considered and today still are considered revolutionary ideas, they couldn't properly be called anarchists.
I think that's right.
Okay. Listen, we have a caller in the 707 area code. I have a new setup here in terms of how I manage the show, and I'm still kind of getting used to it, so I'm not entirely sure whether this person wants to be on the air or not. So I'm going to ask if you can, if you're online, go into the chat room and type in 707 in the chat room, and I'll see if I see you there, then I'll know that you actually want to be on the air. In the meanwhile, you mentioned Thomas Paine and minimalist government and so forth, and one of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading your book was about other forms of political thought. I will admit that for some time, like 3 weeks between my junior and senior year in high school, I was a libertarian. For about 3 weeks, I read Ayn Rand and, you know, the Atlas Shrugged and so forth, The Fountainhead, and found her work to be appealing for some time, and then, you know, I sort of came to my senses. But I was wondering, in terms of anarchy and libertarianism, is there any relationship at all, are there distinctions that ought to be made?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the story is fairly complicated. So if we were in continental Europe, and we use the word libertarian, the word libertarian and the word anarchist would largely be seen as synonymous. Anybody who's in Spain or France talking about him or herself as a libertarian would be saying that she or he was an anarchist, and probably an anarchist of a communist or socialist variety. The first person to use the word libertarian, libertaire, was a French anarchist communist called Béjart in the 1870s, I believe. As we know, by contrast, in the English-speaking world, the majority usage of the term libertarian tends to be for people who are not necessarily anarchists, though of course some would be, but in any case, who are at least proponents of a minimal state. So the kind of position that I want to take in this book is really not designed to resolve disputes as between the communist and socialist anarchists who would use the word libertarian for themselves, especially in continental Europe, or on the other hand, market-oriented anarchists in the English-speaking world. I try in the last chapter to make very clear that my goal here is not to resolve those disputes, but to lay a groundwork for opposition to arbitrary authority, with the understanding that people in a stateless society could undoubtedly experiment in all kinds of different ways, mm-hmm. In terms of developing different social forms. One thing I'd really want to emphasize is that even in the English-speaking world, the word libertarian carries a lot of different kinds of freight. So, you know, Ayn Rand and the approach that she represents clearly energizes lots of people. The folks I hang out with at the Center for a Stateless Society tend to be, in general, considerably less moved by Rand. And would really want to distinguish themselves not from any and all usages of libertarian, because that's a term I think we'd all in some senses be happy with, but those of us associated with the C4SS and the Alliance of the Libertarian Left would want to say that the term libertarian often gets used by people who are not simply pro-freedom and anti-state, but who find, whether deliberately or inadvertently, find themselves engaging in what we often call vulgar libertarianism, which is, and this borrows a usage from Marx, and the idea here is using anti-state rhetoric as a kind of prop for corporate power. We see ourselves as very opposed to the kind of chummy relationship that big business has with the political elite, and we're very opposed to that. We really want to undermine that kind of corporatist power, and we often see people using libertarian rhetoric, but really assuming that existing corporate capitalism is somehow pretty close to what you might expect in a genuinely free society, and we're convinced that that's not the case.
Right. Okay. That is a really important distinction to be made. One of the things that I do note in your book is that you talk about how the state tends to benefit the rich, the powerful, especially in the economic sphere and having to do with corporations and so forth. And so it's interesting that you place the distinction in that place.
We think that's really important. And, of course, it's not just in the narrowly economic sphere, because, of course, when we talk about the state's involvement in war, so much of that involvement in one way or another is also designed to benefit economic elites, both because sometimes military action is designed to create business opportunities for everybody from military contractors to those who will end up having access to resources because of war. The national security state, as it's blossomed in the last 10 years, has provided innumerable opportunities for security contractors to make lots of money. From people
right.
who manufacture airport scanners to people who provide internet search services to the national security state and so forth. So it's definitely true in the narrowly economic sphere. It's also true elsewhere. You know, in the civil liberties context, think about the way in which the private prison industry has enthusiastically embraced the drug war and things like this in order to boost its profits. So I think it happens in a lot of different spheres.
Well, this is a really mind-opening area, at least for me, you know, to think about how legislation that seems to be for the benefit of the people can actually turn out to really be for the benefit of corporations and of the elites.
Can I say just a little about that, actually, because
sure.
I think that's hugely important. And the classic work on this that I think everybody should be acquainted with even now, even though it's over 40 years old, is a work by the great new left historian Gabriel Kalko, and it's called The Triumph of Conservatism. And Kalko shows how in the era at the end of the 19th century through the beginning of the 20th century, the kind of at the height of the so-called progressive era, a great deal of legislation that is sold to the public as designed to somehow tame what is seen as a crazy economic environment really serves primarily to help larger established corporations keep their profits high and shut out competitors. And so the idea is the consumer really gets screwed, but this is represented to the consumer as somehow securing order and benefiting ordinary people. Butler Schaefer carried on Kalko's story in a subsequent book that carried the story on from 1918 to 1938 and looked at the way this again played out during the New Deal era. The book there was called In Restraint of Trade. And the idea in both cases is that we find industry groups saying up front, we just really need to restrain our competitors. And then they say this in a way that implies that somehow this is for the benefit of the public, but it's obvious that what's happening is that the largest players that are politically well-connected really are unhappy that there are other people doing the same things they're doing and perhaps attracting their customers, and they really want to find a way to shut them down. And it's really striking, actually.
It's really interesting you bring that specific thing up. You know, yesterday I had a posting on Facebook that I saw that is about a new regulation coming up here in New York State whereby, and the headline is really funny, they've taken advantage of this, but independent farmers who sell cheese at local farmers markets are no longer allowed to cut their cheese.
Yeah, I think we can see just innumerable examples of this kind of thing. You know, I mean, I'm so delighted that there's a great farmers market that happens every week right near where we live, and there is some neat local stuff that we're able to take advantage of. And I would be quite unhappy if I saw that people had been frozen out there because of these kinds of political impositions. But the reality is that most of the time, most of us as consumers, as people just going about the business of our lives, have very little time and energy and money to influence what goes on in legislation. By contrast, interest groups that may have concerns that put them diametrically at odds with us in terms of their goals do often have the capacity, financially and otherwise, to concentrate their energy, to concentrate their attack on a legislature and push for laws and regulations that are to their benefit. And that simple fact about the economics of lobbying, I think, helps to underscore why we should expect that persistently the wealthy and well-connected who can afford to do that kind of thing are going to be able to extract the kinds of outcomes they want from politicians. Now, politicians may have, their own independent reasons. They may themselves, of course, be members of the financial elite, and they may see ways they can benefit. But even if they're just responding to outside pressure, That pressure is just far more likely to come from those who want to cause problems for us. You know, Adam Smith famously said, I can't reproduce the quote exactly, but he famously said, you know, whenever a proposed piece of legislation or regulation emanates from people in business, we ought to be suspicious.
Sure.
Because he says, you know, we can just expect that if what they're doing is pressing for politically secured privilege, they probably don't have our best interests at heart.
Well, I want to press on that for a moment, though, because as I was reading about this and you were talking about regulations, you know, I understand how it is that a product of that, whether it is a byproduct or the product we can talk about, but, you know, a product of that is that it may serve as a restraint on trade. But as an individual consumer, you know, let's say I'm going to, you mentioned hairdressers in your book, or let's say I'm talking about doctors, you know, areas where things where it's really important to understand the quality of the service that you're receiving. Don't I want there to be regulation there? Don't I want my doctor to be licensed, for example? You know, how else do I ensure that when I go to the doctor, I'm not going to walk out a mess?
Well, so I think there's a combination of factors. The most important thing is that I have no objection, and I think no sane person has any objection to professional certification schemes. The question is simply whether I then have the authority to use force to put somebody out of business who is not in possession of what I regard as the right sort of certification. As a consumer, I think it might be entirely reasonable of me to say, I'm simply not interested in patronizing a hairdresser or a physician or some other professional who hasn't in some way demonstrated in advance a level of competence that's satisfactory to me. But I think it's probably not right to suppose that the only way that can be demonstrated is through some kind of one-size-fits-all licensing scheme that's managed by the state. I worry about those kinds of schemes because they seem so frequently to become the tools by which professional groups really serve to limit the number of entrants and to keep their profits high. And so, if I can just note one obvious example,
mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the 20th century, there were a lot of groups, fraternal organizations of the kind that still survive today in the form of, you know, groups like the Elks and so forth. These were fraternal organizations of working people in America that provided a very robust, given the general state of the economy at that time, a very robust social safety net for their members. And one thing they did was to provide access to medical care for their members.
Okay.
And the way they did this very often was through what came to be called lodge practice, because, of course, these groups are called lodges very often even today. And it was possible to obtain medical care from a legitimate physician in this period through lodge practice for a payment of something that might amount to, say, a day's wages on the part of a lodge member. Those people might pay in, and they would get they'd all pay in, and, you know, that would be what they'd have to pay for a year's worth of medical care. Well, what happened, we notice over time, this was great for the participants in these fraternal organizations, and this is, I'm thinking especially about the U.S., the same kind of thing happened in England, but what happened was that the state medical boards got very unhappy about this, not because there were obvious care problems, but because they didn't like the fact that procedure tended to drive down the profits that their members were able to make. And so they went to great trouble to put physicians who participated in lodge practice arrangements on notice that they were going to be boycotted, their licenses were going to be called into question, and so forth, if they didn't get out of the lodge practice business. And the result ultimately, along with some other legal debilities that were created, the result was that those arrangements went out of business. Mm-hmm. And this was one of many things that tended to make medical care less affordable for ordinary people who had really been able to obtain it otherwise. So I'm very suspicious about those kinds of forcible licensing schemes. Not at all opposed to professionals saying, look, here's why we believe you should choose us, and here's this independent verification of our skills. You decide. But I'm a lot more nervous when they start to use force to achieve that goal, because what that tends to mean is that they shut out alternatives that may really be beneficial to consumers.
Right. So it's less about regulation or finding a way for people to be able to test out the qualifications and the quality of the services that they're receiving, and more about coercion.
Right.
Okay. You know, we literally have about a minute left. Can you believe it? It's just flown by. But I didn't want to leave the show without at least touching on the issue of human nature and hierarchy. It seems to me that historically, people in any society ultimately seem to revert back to a very stratified, hierarchical way of organizing themselves. How does that play into the anarchist model?
Well, so I think that forcible hierarchies are dangerous. Forcible hierarchies create all kinds of opportunities for abuse, and I think we ought to be very nervous about them. If people want voluntary hierarchies because they work for them in one way or another, I'm certainly not going to try to beat them up and stop them from doing that. I, for one, find working in hierarchical environments and functioning in hierarchical social settings distasteful, and I'd like a world in which I didn't have to do that. But if it's really the case, if your empirical claim turns out to be correct, that in one way or another people like functioning in those kinds of settings, more power to them. Please don't use force to sustain them.
Awesome. All right. Gary, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm glad to let people know about your book as well. Please, again, tell us about the title and where they can get the book.
Absolutely. So the book is The Conscience of an Anarchist, Why It's Time to Say Goodbye to the State and Build a Free Society. You can get it on Amazon.com. My name is spelled C-H-A-R-T-I-E-R, and you can search for it that way. You can also get it directly from the publisher, save a dollar as over against Amazon's price. That's freeminds.com. Free is F-R-3-3-M-I-N-D-S. .com, freeminds.com with threes instead of e's, and either that or Amazon will enable you to get the book.
Wonderful, and I will be sure to put up that information on the blog, so folks who are listening and can't write this down right now, no worries, go to untangledresolutions.blogspot.com, and sometime in the afternoon tomorrow, Monday afternoon, well, perhaps Tuesday, because tomorrow's the holiday, we'll have this information up for you so you can get it. Gary, thanks again. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Wonderful. All right, folks, we're going to be leaving the show in just a moment. But first, I'd like to thank listener Jeho Hanan for listening. I got your shout out in. And I'm leaving you with another piece by the Mighty Third Rail. This one is called The Anthem, and it is also from their album Classic. Check out their new album called Death Boogie on iTunes. Enjoy your 4th of July, everyone. Have a wonderful week. Be sure to join me again next week at the same time. Bye for now.
Forward march!
Until our tongues are cut and our throats split. We will speak out until our tongues are cut and our throats split. We will speak out until our tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until our tongues are cut and our throats are slit. Speak, speech, I pray you. With the words I heard while fiddling my fingers in the fountain of forever. In search for thought gems to stem the vines and lines of dominant determination of will. Lifting our voices so that the world may sing. Corresponding chorus carols of a future found in dreams. A division of humanity at its finest. Lifestyles of the spiritually wealthy. Healthy. Helpings of nourishment needed for those in need. Admitting those who plead. Campaigning for silence to succeed. I've witnessed the death of ignorance. So call me Osiris. Vanquish the virus. The villainy from my veins. And sing a verse of change. While trudging barefoot in the snow.
5 degrees below freezing, spitting, heat-seeking similes targeted towards the chest of ice kings and queens who rejected the warmth of their beating hearts. We spark and start revolutions disguised as revelations, attacking the masses with even half a brain. Gunning for the Pied Piper, equipped with epiphanies, armed with a pocket full of promise and a handful of hope. We are a tribe, marching on an unrest quest for songs in the key of life to entice the meek and bleak people. Poison a portrait of paralysis, lost in La La Land as songs hum and drum to a tune of rhythm, crafted by a 20-piece orchestra of men who have sold their souls for gold to hold the souls of others in the palm of their hands. As the tone of a saxophone drones a blue note that God wrote in hopes of someone hearing. And in this deafening reckless of silence, a poet speaks with the power and perception of a prophet, so I follow her footsteps, mimic his movements, validating her voices, vowing to speak out until my tongue is cut and my throat is slit. So let's rise to redemption and haste and harmony. Our art articulates anomalies unanswered. We be like fireflies, occasionally flashing a glimpse of enlightenment. Let's imitate the sun and blaze away, burning brightly and beautifully, glowing gorgeously in a societal fog of uncertainty, illuminating a path directly towards destiny, towards swaying to the melody of, to the melody of, to the melody of. We will speak out until the tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until the tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until our tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until our tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until our tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until our tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until our tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until our tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until the tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until the tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until the tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until the tongues are cut and our throats are slit. We will speak out until the tongues are cut and our throats are slit. Classic.